The President of the United States.
My administration has been steadily and successfully fighting communism. There is no doubt that communists have tried to worm their way into the government service.
It is my opinion that when the era historically is written, it will no longer be referred to as the McCarthy era. It will be called the J. Edgar Hoover era.
Those are the words of the late Frank Wilkinson, and this is Still Spying, presented by the organization he helped to found, Defending Rights and Dissent. I am your host, Chip Gibbons. You can visit us online at stillspying.org or find us on Twitter at stillspying. If you're interested more in Frank's story, you're in luck because that's the subject of our next and final episode. This week, however, we are discussing the role of the FBI in McCarthyism. Later, I'll be joined by Ellen Schrecker, the leading historian of the McCarthy period. In her definitive history of McCarthyism, Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, she wrote, "Had observers known in the 1950s what they learned since the 1970s when the Freedom of Information Act opened the Bureau's files, McCarthyism would probably have been called Hooverism, for the FBI was the bureaucratic heart of the McCarthy era." Political repression against the left has been the norm throughout the history of the U.S., and anti-socialist, anti-communist, or anti-anarchist language has played and continues to play an outsized role in American political discourse. Historian Andre Flesch wrote a fascinating piece in Jacobin magazine called America's First Red Scare, noting how supporters of slavery frequently painted abolitionists as quote-unquote red Republicans bent on abolishing private property. More recently, as protests for racial justice and against police brutality have swept the nation, Donald Trump and others have attacked them as Marxist, anarchist, and quote-unquote left-wing extremist. While the language of Red Scares apparently is always in vogue in U.S. political discourse, historians typically demarcate two major Red Scares in our history. The first period, the first Red Scare, that is, followed the Bolshevik Revolution and the end of World War I. The second Red Scare refers to the early Cold War period, which is frequently dubbed McCarthyism or the McCarthy period. The FBI was central to both Red Scares. The height of the first Red Scare came during the Palmer raids when a young J. Edgar Hoover, heading off the Bureau's newly minted intelligence division, tracked and rounded up radicals across the country. While the second Red Scare is most commonly associated with the demagogic ravings of Joseph McCarthy, McCarthy arrived late on the scene and had a short-lived career. The FBI, on the other hand, was instrumental both publicly and behind the scenes in drumming up anti-communist sentiment and carrying out repression. This is why both historians and victims of the second Red Scare have argued it would be more appropriately named for Hoover than McCarthy. Joining us today is guest Ellen Schrecker.
She is one of the most distinguished historians of the McCarthy era. She is a professor of history emerita at Yeshiva University and has taught at Columbia, Princeton, NYU, and the New School. She is the author of a number of books, including The Lost Soul of Higher Education, Corporatization, The Assault on Academic Freedom, and The End of the American University, No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism and the University, and Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, which was the first book written after the Cold War on the history of McCarthyism, and is today still considered the definitive text on the McCarthy period. So the term McCarthyism gets bandied about in all kinds of contexts. It's pretty fascinating. It seems to have moved beyond just the U.S. I remember I was reading a French language paper one day, and I saw the phrase McCarthyism used to describe events in Turkey. So why don't we start as, what was the McCarthy period and what is McCarthyism?
Okay. McCarthyism is, in one sense, the home front of the early Cold War. It was the longest lasting and most widespread widespread episode of political repression in the history of the United States. And the way I like to use it is quite historically specific. It's much more than the career of Joseph McCarthy. He really is not a minor player, but he's not the key player. It's that moment in the early Cold War, beginning in about 1947 or so, when domestic politics is kind of hijacked by a movement to eliminate all the influence of American communism from American life. And this is very specific. It's not directed against, quote unquote, innocent liberals, although sometimes innocent liberals may be caught up in it because the people who are sort of propagating McCarthyism have a very broad definition of what they think the quote unquote communist menace is. But what it's designed to do is to eliminate the threat that communism supposedly has to American security, a threat that supposedly communists in a labor union in the automobile industry might try to sabotage the assembly line, or the threat that people talked about when they were trying to eliminate quote-unquote communists from the film industry, that some communist actor might insert communist propaganda in a scene or something like that. Clearly, it was a very amount of political repression. It was very successful. The Communist Party, which at its peak in the late 30s and early 40s, probably had at most 100,000 people associated with it, was essentially destroyed, although the Cold War played a major role here, as did the realization on the part of a lot of American communists that not only was joining this very maligned, very marginal political group not very effective, but also they became aware of some of the terrible repression that had occurred in the Soviet Union during the 1930s and 40s. So what we see when we talk about McCarthyism is a movement that spread throughout American society and that was implemented primarily by employers. The main sanctions for this wave of political repression were not criminal prosecution, but employment sanctions. People were fired from their jobs. People were blacklisted. And that was completely effective in squelching a lot of left-wing political activity. It began in the late 40s, and it didn't really peter out until the end of the 1950s. There were still people going to prison under sort of anti-communist statute in anti-communist prosecutions during the early 60s. So it's pretty long lasting, but it's historically specific. I don't like using the word McCarthyism to imply that somebody's making unfounded charges of some kind of politically repressive way. That just is using it incorrectly, I think.
So in your book, Many Are the Crimes, you write, had observers known in the 1950s what they learned since the 1970s when Freedom Information Act opened up the Bureau's files, McCarthyism would probably have been called Hooverism, for the FBI was the bureaucratic heart of the McCarthy era. Could you explain why we would call it Hooverism if we knew now what we didn't know then?
J. Edgar Hoover was the head of the FBI, and during his tenure, he really completely dominated it in every way. And so he had a fixation, we might call it an obsession, with the quote-unquote danger of communism. And throughout his career at the FBI, he focused on uncovering quote-unquote communists and ensuring that they would have no position of influence within American society. That was his goal. And so what he did was really create the machinery for carrying out his own personal anti-communist crusade. He had a lot of allies. There were a lot of other anti-communists in American life. But Hoover really had his fingers in most of the pot, as it were. He was able to create lists. The most important one was called the Security Index. It went through several name changes, but essentially it collected information on thousands, hundreds of thousands of Americans. It, through the use of surveillance, through the use of informers, through the simple collection of programs for, you know, public gatherings in support of Russian war relief, say, took all the names of people who may have given money, and they're on the security index, and when necessary, could be called up before a congressional investigating committee, could have their name slipped if they were a school teacher to the superintendent of schools or the governor, and they would lose their job. The FBI really was central, I can't emphasize this enough, to this political repression of the early Cold War. It was curbed a little bit toward the end of the 1950s when the Supreme Court began to push back against what was going on. But during the height of McCarthyism, from roughly, I'd say, 1947 to 1954, the FBI really ran this, what we might call, machinery of political repression. It collected names. It created scenarios, usually through the use of criminal prosecutions. After all, its main function was to collect information that could be used in criminal prosecutions by the federal government. It did that, gave information to prosecutors, and was able to successfully assist in the prosecution of, for example, the Ethel and Julius Rosenberg for their quote-unquote atomic spying. It collected information for blacklists. It collected information that could be used in prosecutions of the top leaders of the Communist Party under something called the Smith Act, which made it criminal.
And this is Foley Square style.
Yes.
Foley Square trial, right?
Right. Which made it a crime to teach or advocate the overthrow of the government by force and violence. And this sort of fuzzy and ultimately largely unconstitutional law, though it's still in the books, was used to throw the top leaders, maybe about 100 people, of the Communist Party into prison until the Supreme Court began to roll back some of what the McCarthy era prosecutions were doing. It was also used, and this is very important, in the creation of the federal government's loyalty security program that President Harry Truman created in the beginning of 1947. He did this because the Republican Party had just won control of Congress in the 1946 election and was clearly threatening to create a anti-communist program for investigating and, what would we say, cleansing the federal bureaucracy. And Truman rushed his program into operation to head Congress off. Unfortunately, the Truman 1947 loyalty security program was essentially designed by the FBI. The FBI was given the task of investigating every single federal employee and clearing them or not. So, and this was a program that then becomes a political test for employment that is copied by state and local governments. It's particularly important to realize about how McCarthyism operated was that it was these anti-communist political tests for employment designed initially by the FBI that made it so effective and that operated within government at many levels, but also operated within school systems, within universities, within private industry, within the broadcasting industry, within Hollywood, and essentially forced people to sort of either cooperate, i.e. give more names if they're called up by a congressional committee, or else lose their job.
So Hoover first comes into the picture at what was then the Bureau of Investigation, later the FBI, as head of the Radical Division and then General Intelligence Division, where he carries out the Palmer raids. So right from his entry point on the national scene, well before the Cold War, he has this sort of vitriolic anti-communist crusade he wants to carry out. How does the rise of the Cold War help Hoover or affect Hoover in that sort of agenda of his anti-communist crusade?
Yeah, well, Hoover had, and I think you're right to begin the story back in the aftermath of World War I, Hoover really had been sort of obsessive in his campaign against the American left, but and American radicalism. But he had been reined in by the Department of Justice during the 1920s and 30s. But he was a brilliant, absolutely brilliant bureaucratic operator. He knew how to play up to the people with power and was able to sort of get himself in FDR, Franklin Roosevelt's good graces. Roosevelt loved him. He would feed Roosevelt information about his political enemies. And so Roosevelt, by the late 30s, is willing to sort of hand Hoover control over subversive activities. That continues throughout the war. Hoover, although he wasn't supposed to be collecting information on the left, nonetheless did and hid it. He was rather devious. The attorney general, who was his immediate superior, told him to get rid of one of his security indexes, and instead Hoover just changes its name. So through a combination of kind of brilliant propaganda, what we would call brown nosing, you know, sucking up to the president in particular, and also apparently collecting a lot of dirt on people with power, he was able to amass an enormous amount of control over this witch hunt that he had been trying to create since, you know, the end of World War I. And what happens is he vastly expands the operations of the FBI during World War II, looking for German spies, looking for saboteurs, whatever. Then after the war, he takes advantage of the Cold War, which is just beginning to ramp up in the late 1940s, and is able to hype the threat of communist spies and saboteurs through a number of criminal prosecutions. He works with congressional committees to work, for example, very closely with Richard Nixon, who is a member of the House Un-American Activities Committee, to ensure that the case of Alger Hiss is pursued as a way of publicizing the quote-unquote threat of communism. And this is something he works with members of the Republican Party. The Republican Party had been pushing the line that the New Deal administration of Franklin Roosevelt and later Harry Truman was soft on communism, that it had allowed a number of communists to gain influence within the New Deal administration. Now, these charges were plausible. There were communists who did work in a number of New Deal agencies, and there were a number of them who actually gave information illegally to the Soviet Union. That did happen. And in fact, as we know, these spies gave away information about the building of the atomic bomb. So, you know, it wasn't a non-existent threat. But by 1947, 48, 49, that threat had disappeared. In other words, American communists had been, not many at all, but there were some in the New Deal in the government, and they had engaged in a certain amount of espionage with giving information to the Soviet Union, largely because they believed that this would help win the war. They were not doing it, at least in their heads. They did not think they were betraying their country. They thought that American anti-communism, which did exist within the American government, was creating barriers, as it were, to helping the Soviet Union, which had been in the forefront of the fight against Hitler since 1941. So, and what happened is the Republicans made charges that not just that communists had given the secret of the bomb to the Russians, but also that communists had betrayed China to Mao Zedong, that the triumph of the Chinese Communist Party in the Chinese Revolution after the Second World War had been facilitated by communist subversives in the State Department. That was totally off the wall. The United States had no control over what was going on in China, but it was a mission that a number of right-wingers and Republican politicians propagated, and charges of losing China and communists in the State Department losing China were picked up by none other than Joseph McCarthy.
So one of the most fascinating things to me about how the FBI has, what they did was they would gather information on their opponents, and then they would release it in these sort of notorious blind memorandums. They'd give it to the media. I know in your book, you mentioned a case of a university administrator getting one. Something interesting I uncovered when I was writing a Jacobin article about the FBI file of George Crockett, who later went on to be a member of Congress, but had been one of the lawyers for the Communist Party leadership charged under the Smith Act and went to jail, was that when he was criminal court judge, there was an issue where there was a shootout between these people the FBI called. This is in the late 60s, early 70s, so slightly after the McCarthy period. But they called a black extremist. They were illegally arrested by the police. George Crockett doesn't throw the arrest out. He grants them bond, which is, you know, the least he could do in this situation. And Hoover, who was obsessed with Crockett. And if you really want a good look at how the FBI worked over the decades, Crockett's FBI file is interesting because you have everything from the background check to the Foley Square trial, to COINTELPRO. But when he granted bond to these people, they put together a blind memorandum on his communist ties and released them to the media to try to destroy his reputation. And this is someone who holds an elected judgeship. So the FBI's role in sort of spreading anti-communist causes beyond just the government is very, very interesting to me. So you mentioned that in the late 50s, the Supreme Court put some checks on the FBI. How did the FBI respond to those checks?
Oh,
is this when they developed COINTELPRO?
COINTELPRO, yes. That's the origin of COINTELPRO. It's the case of a man named Clinton Jenks, who I wrote about in many other crimes. He was a Communist Party member, union organizer, a veteran. He was involved with hard rock miners, zinc miners, copper miners in southern New Mexico, most of them Mexican-Americans. And he was prosecuted for perjury, because he was a labor official and the Taft-Hartley law had provisions that had been put into this legislation when it was passed in 1947, the early stages of the Cold War, the early stages of McCarthyism, that every union official had to sign an anti-communist affidavit. And so a number of officials in this particular union, which had communists in its leadership, were prosecuted under it for perjury, for falsifying their affidavits. Clinton Jenks' appeals goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court essentially overturns the conviction on the grounds that of the testimony that had been used to prove that Jenks was a communist when he signed the oath was the testimony of a well-known professional witness who had recanted his testimony and said that he had lied in a number of cases. So the court said that the only way that the defense could have a fair trial was that the government had to let the Clinton Jenks' lawyers look at his FBI file to see if the witness had falsified his testimony. And Hoover forced the Justice Department to drop the case because he didn't want any FBI files ever to reach the public. And at that point, he realizes that, you know, he can't bring these kinds of cases using FBI means. I mean, there were a lot of things, not just informers, but wiretaps and so-called black bag jobs where the FBI would break into somebody's office and essentially photograph that organization's Rolodex and mailing lists, things like that. So in order to keep its operation secret, they abandoned the use of criminal prosecutions, essentially, after 1957, and instead organized this COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program of dirty tricks designed to sort of disrupt and subvert illegally, completely illegally, Hoover's enemies. And so you've got this massive program of dirty tricks that is the way the FBI responded to the Supreme Court's refusal to let them get away with them.
Yeah, and it goes well beyond the Communist Party and well past the McCarthy period.
Yes,
expand
yes,
it to
yes.
The Socialist Workers Party. They use it ruthlessly against the Black Panther Party. We did an entire episode on Fred Hampton, who is a really tragic case of FBI misconduct. So what was the impact on our democracy and for various social movements like the labor movement or the civil rights movement of McCarthyism?
Well,
do we still feel its effects to this day?
Yes, very much so. Basically, what it did was I'll give you an example. When I was teaching, and I teach a course on sort of recent American history, I would ask my students to tell me about the anti-war movement during the Korean War. Now, according to the polls, the Korean War was every bit as unpopular as the Vietnam War. So I say, tell me about the anti-war movement. This was an unpopular war. And I get complete silence. And I say, yeah, that's the right answer. There essentially was no mass anti-war movement during the Korean War. Why? When did the Korean War take place? 1950 to 53, the absolute high point of McCarthyism. In other words, there was no criticism of a very unpopular war because the people who would have criticized it, many of them close to the Communist Party, who would have sort of said, you know, this is especially once the American forces past the 38th parallel, it didn't exist. There are other things as well. The labor movement, the Taft-Hartley Act, which required these anti-communist affidavits, made it possible to eliminate communists from the labor movement. And during the 1930s and 40s, as the American labor movement was being organized, communists were very important. There weren't a lot of them, but they were very hardworking. They were very dedicated. Communists were politically a group that was devoted to, quote unquote, the working class. And so they sent their most active members, their most dedicated members into the labor movement. So you have a labor movement that whose left wing is totally destroyed by McCarthyism. And what that meant in a lot of cases was these left unions were the unions that were pushing a broader form of unionism than just better wages and benefits for their workers. In North Carolina, for example, there were communist-led unions in the tobacco industries that were conducting voter registration within the Black community. You had the same thing happening in Clinton Jenks's miners union, which was dedicated, its main members were Hispanics, Mexicans, and the communists within the labor, on the left of the labor movement, were working to create sort of community-wide labor movement. You have communists in the film industry who were making films that had a sort of social justice messages. You know, not openly communist, but nonetheless, there was a film made about a strike of these Mexican-American workers called Salt of the Earth, which is a kind of, you know, 1940s movie or 1950s movie, you know, pretty proletarian kitsch. But nonetheless, it's about a real labor strike and about working conditions and about Mexicans and subjects that Hollywood certainly would not have touched during this period. So what we're talking about is a lot of things that didn't happen. I did a book, for example, on McCarthyism in the universities. And the people I interviewed told me, well, there were certain topics they didn't do research on. There were certain words they didn't use in their writing. They tended not to use the word capitalism, but instead talked about industrialism. You know, various forms of self-censorship that existed even though people weren't necessarily losing their jobs. What you had was a shrinking, a narrowing of political discourse within the American public. So that, for example, there was a push during the Truman administration for a national health insurance program. It was attacked as quote-unquote socialized medicine, completely banished from American politics until what? Bernie Sanders has resuscitated it. So we're seeing many lost opportunities as a result of McCarthyism.
Do you think, I know McCarthyism is a specific historical period, but do you think there's lessons for today's time period? We've seen, like you said, Bernie Sanders, we've seen a lot of protest against racial injustice. And the response from the top has been to call them Marxist. Donald Trump actually issued an executive order about the the statutes that were being toppled. And I'm going to read you part of it because I have to read it to believe this was in an executive order in the year of 2020. Many of the rioters, arsonists, and left-wing extremists who have carried out and supported these acts have explicitly identified themselves with ideologies such as Marxism that call for the destruction of the United States government. Anarchists and left-wing extremists have sought to advance a fringe ideology that paints the United States of America as fundamentally unjust and have sought to impose that ideology on Americans through violence and mob intimidation. There was a hearing where Barr came to testify about his own actions before Congress, and one of the Republican members, Louis Gomar, started talking about David Horowitz, who he described as an ex-communist turned, I know you're familiar with this, attack on the academy, and asked Bill Barr if he was aware of Marxist plans to get themselves killed by the police in order to then incite revolution. Do you think there are lessons from that period for this moment? And what should activists who are interested in struggling for racial justice or for less economic inequality, what should they take from this?
Well, I think the big difference between the McCarthy period and today is that during the McCarthy period, every single element of mainstream society was anti-communist, belonged to this anti-communist consensus, and collaborated. I mean, today there is pushback. There are a lot of people in the street. There weren't people in the street. I mean, you know, the thing is, Donald Trump really is worse. His ideology is worse. His actions are worse. The man is, I hate to use the F word, but he is certainly a proto-fascist in his political orientation, and he is the president of the United States. It's terribly scary, but it's scary in a different way. We are seeing pushback. Unfortunately, what we're also seeing is collaboration. And that was what made McCarthyism so successful, was the collaboration of mainstream politicians. And we're seeing, you know, certainly in the form of the Republican Party, some serious collaboration there. And what's frightening, of course, is that the court has been already packed, the Supreme Court. So there is no serious judicial pushback to kind of save democratic practices. I mean, I'm very scared here, but it's different from McCarthyism. But nonetheless, you know, we have to be out there and we have to be alert and we have to be really careful that we use the truth and do not censor ourselves.
Professor Schrecker, thank you so much for joining the Still Spying podcast. It's been an honor to have you on as our guest. And for people listening at home, whenever people ask me to recommend a book on the history of FBI surveillance or political repression generally, I always give the same answer, and that's Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, which is, you know, a book about McCarthyism, not just the FBI, but really paints the picture of the role of the FBI as a force of political repression in this country and its consequences. So thank you so much for joining the podcast. And our next episode will be out 2 weeks from now.
Thank you very much.